One down, one to go. Two Republican congressional candidates, fresh from winning primary election nominations, resetting their campaign targets on Democratic incumbents. We're questioning Republicans Ben Lang and John Archer on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation,
the Iowa Gaming Association, consisting of 18 state-licensed casinos, which are a viable part of Iowa's economy and adding value to the state's entertainment and tourism industries with nearly 23 million visitors each year.
Iowa banks know you want honest advice about how to best reach your financial goals. Whether it's financing and education, buying a new home, growing a business, or funding retirement, Iowa banks, Iowa values. MyIowaBank.com.
The Rotary Clubs of Iowa and Rotary International.
In 1985, Rotary International committed to a goal of ending polio worldwide. Very soon now, after immunizing over 2 billion children, the goal will be achieved. Rotary, humanity in motion.
For decades, Iowa Press has brought you politicians and newsmakers from across Iowa and beyond, celebrating 41 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa Public Television. This is the Friday, June 15 edition of Iowa Press. Here is Dean Borg.
Ben Lang and John Archer have some things in common. They're both attorneys. Both are Republicans running for Congress in eastern Iowa districts against incumbent Democrats, and both are carrying the Republican nomination after winning primary elections. In the first district, Ben Lang of Independence is opposing incumbent Bruce Braley. It's his second campaign to take Braley's congressional seat, losing 2 years ago by less than 2 percentage points of the total vote. This time, the first district is redrawn, though. Davenport and Clinton are out. Cedar Rapids, Marshalltown, Marengo, and Decorah are in. And speaking of Davenport and the Quad Cities cluster of communities, John Archer lives in Bettendorf. He's a John Deere corporate attorney, and he's serving right now in the Pleasant Valley School Board, but this is his first political campaign carrying the Republican nomination, this time against incumbent 2nd District Congressman Dave Lobsack. Gentlemen, welcome to Iowa Press.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And across the Iowa Press table, Radio Iowa News Director Kay Henderson, and James Lynch, who writes for the Gazette, published in Cedar Rapids.
Mr. Archer, what is your main argument for replacing Congressman Dave Lobsack?
Well, he's been in office for 6 years, and it's been his performance. Just recently, the Des Moines Register, as you know, has voted Congressman Lobsack the least effective member of the Iowa delegation. And I think House Minority Leader Steny Hoyer said it best. He's new, he's been in office for 6 years, but yet he's still getting his feet on the ground. So we have a very weak incumbent here in the 2nd District, and it has to be his performance the last 6 years.
Just to correct, I don't think the Des Moines Register voted him. They were reporting actual polls by somebody else.
That's correct. Yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Mr. Lang, you tried to unseat Congressman Braley last time there was an election here in Iowa. What will be different this time around?
I think we first start with, as Dean mentioned, the redistricting. The redistricting is significantly improved for us. You know, we cut that registration advantage in half from about 8% down to 4%. Governor Branstad just won this district by 5,000 votes. So redistricting has been a great improvement for us. But the bottom line is, as John mentioned, is policy. You know, I'm out there talking to folks about the issues that people care about, and Bruce has been a complete failure on national debt when we talk about the health care bill. Those policies people care about, free trade is another one, and I think those are going to continue to be the forefront.
Redistricting isn't the only thing that's different this time. You're not going to have the element of surprise that you had 2 years ago. Bruce Braley knows you're coming after him. He's raised more money. He's likely to report raising $1 million by the end of this quarter. How do you compensate? How do you change the campaign to make up for those elements?
Well, there is no doubt. He'll have the resources. You know, checks from trial attorneys across this nation funnel into eastern Iowa to buy this House seat for him, and that'll continue to be the case. So we go out there and we talk to people about the policy, because policy is what, you know, that's what people care about. That's what they go to the voting booth and talk about. They don't talk about, you know, who raised what resources from where. They talk about policy, and I'm going to continue to do that. And that's why I think we have a winning argument. Bruce has voted 7 times to increase the national debt limit, voted voted against the balanced budget amendment on the House floor. That's what upsets Iowans, because he fails to understand the profound moral failure we are facing as a nation in our national debt.
And Mr. Archer, you alluded to Congressman Loebsack just getting his feet on the ground. Does it make sense to replace a newcomer with a even more newcomer? Someone who, you know, replacing somebody with 6 years' experience with someone with no experience?
Well, you talk about experience, and having worked for John Deere the past 12 years, a multinational corporation, being part owner of a Bettendorf-based manufacturing company, and serving on the Pleasant Valley School Board, I have the experience. And this country needs some real leadership when it comes to our fiscal issues. And Congressman Loebsack has just been a rubber stamp for the failed Obama policies. We need to bring that business experience to the United States Congress and get our fiscal house back in order.
Mr. Lang, you've acknowledged, I heard you in a debate with your primary challenger, Mr. Blum, you're acknowledging the fact that you're going to need help not only from Republicans but from independents to your campaign in order to get the job done if you're going to serve in Congress. What kind of a message do you think that you have attracts independents? Because your message is very, very conservative.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, the redistricting, the largest voting bloc, is the independent voters. And so we aren't out there talking Republican this or Democrat that. We're talking about the issues that people care about. And when they see what has happened to the next generation in our national debt, $16 trillion. My three daughters, as you know, $150,000 in debt. Whether you're independent, Democrat, or Republican, folks care about that, because that is taking away the next generation's ability to succeed and have the better opportunity that we have here in America.
And Mr. Archer, also in the Iowa Republican Party and nationwide, but Iowa right now, there's a big Ron Paul influence. And you're going to have to attract within the Republican Party that. Are you going to be able to do that?
I think so. The excitement that the Ron Paul individuals have brought, the enthusiasm, is palpable. And I think we'll take that momentum as the Republican nominee here in the 2nd District, and we'll take that directly and face Dave Loebsack with that. So I don't see a problem with attracting the Ron Paul individuals at all.
That's a youth demographic.
Absolutely. And having Iowa City and Johnson County in our new district, that's going to be very, very favorable for us.
But do those Ron Paul positions, those Tea Party positions that you, Mr. Lang, have talked about, will they attract the independent voters, or are they looking for someone who's more bipartisan, willing to compromise on to get solutions?
Well, as I've said repeatedly, you still have to talk about policy, and whether it's a libertarian, a Ron Paul supporter, or a Mitt Romney supporter, the national debt is the national debt, and we're all Americans. We all have to live with under it. And so I think you go out there and you continue to talk about that, and we are drawing that bright contrast, because Bruce Braley has again failed to recognize the importance of it, and we're offering an alternative in the policies that we support that libertarians, independents, Democrats, Republicans all can get behind my candidacy because of that.
Mr. Archer, what sort of role will the presidential campaign play in your race? There's no statewide competition in Iowa this year. There are 4 congressional races. Does Mitt Romney at the top of the ticket help or hurt you?
Oh, I think it helps. Iowa is in play with our six electoral votes. We will see Governor Romney in Davenport next week, as your viewers may already know. There will be a lot of attention here in Iowa. I was talking to Ben earlier. I'm very optimistic that we will put 4 Republican congressmen in Washington, D.C. in November. So the 2nd District, and Scott County being the largest county in the 2nd District, is certainly in play. And I anticipate Governor Romney to spend a lot of time here in Iowa.
Are your views in sync with those of Mitt Romney?
I would say for the most part they're in sync with Governor Romney. You look at his experience, his business experience, his experience with the Olympics, bringing that business perspective to Washington, D.C. to solve the nation's debt crisis, the $16 trillion of debt, the $1.6 trillion of deficit spending.
Where would you like him? You were a little hesitant there when she asked that question. Where would you like Governor Romney to move a little bit more to what you believe?
Well, I think we need to be more aggressive. I think we need to take our message to the voters, to the Democrats, to the independents. And it's a winning message, as Ben mentioned. You know, our policy positions are spot on. They are winning positions, and I think we just need to be a bit more aggressive in articulating our vision for where America has to be tomorrow and 5 years from today.
Mr. Lang, on caucus night, a majority of Iowa Republicans voted for someone else They didn't vote for Mitt Romney. He didn't win a majority of Republican votes on caucus night. How do you combat the idea that there's sort of this idea that maybe Iowa Republicans aren't united behind Mitt Romney? And does that impact your ability to get Republicans energetic about your candidacy?
Well, I don't combat it. I mean, what we have to have is a unified front. If we are going to defeat President Obama in November, and if we're going to defeat Bruce Braley in November. And so I don't combat it. What I do is I continue to talk about the policy. And I know I've said this about six times now, but national debt, jobs, economy, health care, free trade agreements, that's what people want to talk about. That's why they get up off the couch, go to that ballot booth, and get involved in the process. And I think that's the winning message out there. And whether Mitt Romney supporters, Ron Paul, Rick Santorum supporters, they will come together because four more years of President Obama is unacceptable.
Jim, just let me ask, the free trade agreements, what's wrong with free trade agreements? Iowa depends a lot on free trade.
I absolutely agree with you, Dean. And that's where Bruce Braley has yet to vote for a single free trade agreement.
You were not saying free trade agreements are bad.
No, I was saying absolutely. I'm 100% supportive of them. And I think that's, again, a bright contrast where we have pork producers. The first congressional district is the second or third largest pork producing congressional district in the nation. And we have Bruce Braley who votes against South Korea, Panama, and Colombia free trade agreements, and they're signed into law. And those issues matter because that doesn't just affect pork producers, manufacturers. These are an opportunity to go sell our products to other markets out there. And we have a congressman that is voting against that on the House floor that hurts jobs and the economic development we have here in eastern Iowa.
Jim. This morning, the White House announced a change in immigration policy that for people who came here illegally as youngsters will be able to get work permits and will be safe from deportation. It incorporates parts of the DREAM Act. Should this be the federal or the national immigration policy going forward?
Well, I personally think that our immigration policy is upside down. We've made it too easy for those individuals that want to be here illegally to be here illegally, and yet we've made it more difficult for those individuals that want to be here legally. We've put the roadblocks up. This is a national security issue, and this is one area where I think the federal government has underreached its authority. Now we have states that are implementing their own laws and passing their own laws, and the federal government is filing lawsuits against those states. I'm not familiar with what the White House just articulated this morning, but this is one area where the federal government has underreached its authority, in my opinion.
Should we allow those people to stay? If they've been here, came here as youngsters and have been here for, I think the policy is more than 5 years.
Right. Well, I think we need to address the problem in a step process. The first is we have to stop the southern border. We have to secure that first because we can't have an understanding of the problem until we know what is taking place in the southern border. And we secure that southern border first, then we recognize how many people are here illegal. Is it 10 to 15 million? We need to draw them out of the shadows. We can draw them out of the shadows by making it more difficult on employers to employ them because, you know, we are for immigration, just not illegal immigration. My father worked in a meat processing facility over in Council Bluffs, and you talk to the people that went through the process legally, that came through the proper channels to Iowa, to America, and they will tell you, we don't support amnesty. We support the rule of law. That's why we came here. But I also think there's a human element to it. But before we can ever get to that process, we need to secure that southern border first.
Gentlemen, it's more than likely the U.S. Supreme Court in the next few days will issue a ruling on the Health Care Reform Act. Mr. Archer, if the Supreme Court rules it's unconstitutional, are there elements of it that you would like to see re-implemented?
I think there are certainly some elements, such as the allowing individuals under 26 to stay on their parents' insurance policy, the transparency tends to be good, ensuring those with pre-existing conditions. And I hope that there are plans in the works right now, contingency plans that individuals are working on to address what takes place in the Supreme Court here in the next couple weeks. If it's ruled unconstitutional or if it's upheld, we need those contingency plans in place.
But what do you say to insurance companies who say if the pool of people in the insurance pool is not everybody, we can't afford to insure people with pre-existing conditions? What do you say to insurance companies? Don't make us do that.
Well, you know, that's a tough decision for insurance companies to make, but we have to realize that those individuals with pre-existing conditions need insurance as well. And insurance companies or individuals are going to have to make that tough decision.
Isn't this, Mr. Lang, Wouldn't that be, in effect, like mandating that insurance companies cover people with pre-existing conditions? That's messing around with the marketplace if insurance companies say, our actuarial tables say this doesn't make business sense.
Right. Well, we already have insurance regulations. I mean, we have, if an employer wants to go out there and get a quote to provide insurance for their employees, they maybe get two, maybe three different opportunities from different companies. So we already have regulation in the marketplace. The question is how much regulation and what type of regulation we have. And for the first time in America's history, you mentioned it, there's an opportunity for the Supreme Court to rule that unconstitutional mandate, rule upon that. And I think it's critical because people, and I can say this traveling across northeastern Iowa, healthcare, Obamacare, is still one of the top one or two issues that people call to my attention that they can't fathom that the federal government is going to force them to purchase a product from a private company.
But you, like Mr. Archer, would force insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions and let parents keep children on their policies to the age of 26?
Well, certainly the pre-existing conditions. But I think more importantly, what we need to do is regulate the marketplace in the sense of, if there is a company in Utah that can provide the best quality of health insurance in Iowa, then let's let them compete. Let's open up the marketplace. But, you know, we can put those parameters that Iowans have that we deem necessary for our population. I think one thing we've learned from Obamacare is that a one-size-fits-all mandate of health care across this country is not going to work, because I would much rather have the people in Iowa making those decisions as opposed to Washington, D.C.
Mr. Archer, go ahead. Jim.
If the Supreme Court upholds Obamacare and you go to Washington, will you try to repeal it, and what will you replace it with?
Well, I'll tell you, I will try to repeal it, but I think that's where Republicans lose. You can't stop and end the sentence by just saying repeal. It has to be repeal and place it with patient-centered health care reform. I talk about my small business. We've had to transition from a standard health insurance plan to a high-deductible HSA because we couldn't afford the 20% premium increases every year. So I acknowledge that as Republicans, it is repeal, but we don't go back to the status quo because the status quo isn't working in the marketplace.
Mr. Archer?
I completely agree with Ben. It has to be consumer-driven. We have to allow individuals to have the health savings account, and we have to open up across state lines to let the free market work.
Mr. Lang, you've repeatedly, during our conversation here, have referred to the federal deficit, the federal debt. How would you reconcile, then, farm legislation, which, if you're elected to Congress, you may get a chance to vote on if this current Congress cannot enact a renewal of the expiring legislation right now? But so how do you reconcile what's needed for corn and soybean farmers in your district?
Right.
That's cost, and it's not only support, it's food assistance for needy people.
Excellent question. And as I've told, I've been on the Farm Bureau circuit the past month, going to Farm Bureau meetings, pork producer meetings, and talking to them.
So what are you telling them?
What I tell them is, look, we need a glide path off of this government subsidies, because we need a free marketplace that allows different energy sources to compete, ethanol being one of them. However, that level playing field needs to be established, and that is both for the oil industry and for the ethanol industry. And I'm up front with them about that. In fact, my father-in-law is a corn grower as well, and he acknowledges that same aspect of it, that we are prepared to compete on a level playing field so long as that playing field is in fact fair with both the oil industry and the ethanol producers.
So you would repeal tax credits and breaks for the oil industry?
Well, what I talk about with the oil industry is making sure that ethanol has the opportunity to put their product out in the marketplace. The renewable fuel standards, as you know, if we don't have those in place, there is no incentive for the oil industry to mix their product with them. So it has to be to a point where both have an opportunity to access the marketplace, and whether that's through a tax break repeal or other type of mechanisms to force the ethanol producers and the corn or the oil industry to have an opportunity to sell their products. I think that's the winning message, because people don't want to continue to throw government money one way or the other. We want consumers, we want Iowans to choose what is in our best interest, what is the best energy source for us.
Do I understand that you're in favor then of scaling back appropriations to farm safety net price protection and food assistance?
Well, I think that's already at the table, and I think you're seeing that on the Senate side as well.
I'm asking how much scale back for you.
Well, I'm not familiar with what the number is right now in negotiations with the Senate. But what
the word
I am
abolish
with,
isn't there.
The word abolish isn't there in the sense of we have to make it our goal to ultimately get to that point, because we need a free market principle. We need a free market competition.
Mr. Archer?
having been at the World Pork Expo last Thursday, I mean, we've heard time and time again that farmers do not want direct payments. And that's what we have to take off the table. What farmers want here in Iowa and across America is a safety net for a catastrophic disaster, a severe drought. And so that's the direction we have to move. We also have to move in a direction where we call the farm bill what it really is. Right now, it's a food bill. And we need to start thinking about separating these monstrosities, these very large bills, Obamacare comes to mind, down to something simpler. Independent pieces of legislation that can be acted upon in a timely manner and can be read and thoroughly analyzed by all parties involved.
All right, separate it right here then. Separate food assistance from a farm safety net for price protection. What about food assistance, the SNAP program, which we formerly knew as food stamps?
Right. Still, we certainly need that assistance. We need to modify it or reform it slightly.
How?
Absolutely no question about that. The details I'm not 100% familiar with right now, but the situation that we're in this country is going to require a lot of reform. As Ben mentioned, $16 trillion of debt and $1.6 trillion of deficit spending.
But what I'm really getting at here is cutting back on food assistance then to those who can't afford to buy food.
Well, what we need to do is, I think in the Obama presidency, more and more individuals have been on food stamps than ever before in history. So we need to get those people back employed, back standing on their own, so we can do away with this assistance by the federal government. We need people working again here in Iowa and across America.
To continue to talk about the sort of budget issues, the Ryan budget has become sort of the alternative to Obama's budget. Do you support the Ryan budget? And how do you see that impacting Social Security and Medicare, which a lot of Iowans depend upon?
Right. Well, again, talking about reforms, I'd be remiss sitting here if I did not say that 43% of the federal government is made up of entitlements. And so we need to tackle these issues, these very difficult issues. Let's take Social Security, for example. We need to reform that. We can't change it for those individuals who are currently relying upon it or those individuals who are within several years of relying upon it. But for somebody my age, am I currently relying upon Social Security to be in existence? No, I'm looking out for my own interest. So we need to raise the retirement age. We need to means test Social Security. So somebody who has paid into the system that has done quite well for themselves throughout their life might not be entitled to the Social Security benefits. But we would be foolish not to think that we can get out of this economic situation that we're in without some type of reform to those entitlement systems.
Mr. Lang, I've heard you offer a similar approach to Social Security. This two-track Social Security program, doesn't it become unwieldy and just sort of increase the federal bureaucracy here, maintaining two programs?
You know as well as I do, James, we'll see an ad up in October, November saying that Ben Lang doesn't care about Social Security or any other crazy ideas out there. But the bottom line is we have enough guts to fix the problem. Because if a politician walks in this room or any others and tells us Social Security is okay, they're flat out lying to us. The demographics have changed. When Social Security was put in place, we had 42 workers for every one retiree. We had a life expectancy of 58 to 60. Now that number is two or three workers for a retiree. We have a life expectancy of 78 to 80. And I say those numbers because I want to make the case to the people out there that this isn't a matter of choosing a winner or a loser. This is a matter of realizing that the numbers simply don't add up anymore. The demographics have caused this problem.
Do you raise the retirement age? Do you go to means testing?
Well, as I've talked about, you mentioned it there, a two-track system. That generation, my father being 62, I understand how Social Security is important to him and others out there. For that older generation, we're going to honor that promise. And as John mentioned, our generation, we're going to look at each other in the eye and say, look, this program simply cannot stand on its own two feet as is currently set up. So we have a two-track system where the older generation will get what they promised. The younger generation will have the opportunity to have the same investment opportunities as members of Congress have through the Thrift Savings Plan. I don't see why, if a member of Congress can have that opportunity, why a younger generation can as well.
So what is the cutoff then? At what age would someone be able to get out of the system?
Well, I think what
40?
We do... We have, 30? Well, I think we have a graduated scale. And I think we have a graduated scale because once you set a line in the sand, then you're going to run into that group of people that are going to be on the short side of it. So we have a graduated scale down on age so that they have the opportunity to still stay in a part of the traditional system, if you want to call it that. And the younger generation will have the opportunity to have that thrift savings plan, if you will, like members of Congress have.
Mr. Archer, last summer there was a huge brouhaha in Washington over the debt ceiling. Would you vote to raise the debt ceiling as a member of Congress?
We might be faced with that vote here early next year as a member of Congress, and no, I would not vote to raise the debt ceiling once again.
So what's the answer without raising the debt ceiling?
We don't know the ramifications, but we have given politicians enough time to fix the problems that currently exist. And if those ramifications are severe, then we will have to deal with them at the appropriate time. But we have to draw a line in the sand saying enough is enough. We have to get our fiscal house in order. And if we can't do it, then we will unfortunately have to deal with those ramifications.
Mr. Lang, would you vote to raise the debt ceiling?
Well, I think it's important for voters to understand what the debt ceiling is. And that's essentially the credit card that the federal government has. So in our family budget, if the credit card has gotten to a point where we need to stop putting money on the credit card, well, then we stop doing that. And I think that's where we are with the federal government. We stop increasing that. And what happens, what does a family have to do? They have to start addressing the expense side of it. That's the real driver of this problem, the mandatory spending. We have to address that side before we ever get to the national debt vote.
I've heard you in favor of abolishing the Department of Education. Federal?
I don't believe you've heard that from me.
Okay.
What I have talked about, shifting the education policy-making decisions from the federal level to the state level to the local level, and because I want people closest to the children making those decisions.
Mr. Archer, the role of the federal government in education.
I would abolish the Department of Education, serving on the Pleasant Valley School Board. Now, we're not going to be able to do it tomorrow or next year, but we need to phase that out. And I, like Ben, believe that we need to empower those closest to the children to make the decisions. And that starts with parents. Parents, I believe, know better than individuals on school boards or municipalities or Des Moines or Washington what their children need best.
So the role of the federal government would be nil.
Nil. That's right. Correct.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Dean.
Thank you.
We'll be back with another edition next week, Iowa Press, usual time, 7:30 Friday night. Second chance to see the show Sunday at noon. I'm Dean Borg. Thank you for joining us today.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation,
the Iowa Gaming Association, consisting of 18 state-licensed casinos, which are a viable part of Iowa's economy and adding value to the state's entertainment and tourism industries with nearly 23 million visitors each year.
Support comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Iowa banks work with you to offer products and advice for financing and education, buying a new home, growing a business, or funding retirement. Iowa Banks, Iowa Values. MyIowaBank.com.
The Rotary Clubs of Iowa and Rotary International.
In 1985, Rotary International committed to a goal of ending polio worldwide. Very soon now, after immunizing over 2 billion children, the goal will be achieved. Rotary, humanity in motion.